Welcome to the Council of Institutional Investors podcast on corporate governance and capital markets regulation. I'm Jeff Mahoney, General Counsel of CII. The purpose of these monthly episodes is to update CII members and the general public on significant developments in U.S. corporate governance and capital markets regulation and CII's related advocacy activities. This update covers the period from April 4th to May 2nd, 2023. The following is my top 10 list of events over that period. Number 10. On April 13th, U.S. House of Representatives Financial Services Committee Chair Patrick McHenry of North Carolina and House Financial Services Subcommittee on Capital Markets Chair Ann Wagner of Missouri sent a letter to Securities and Exchange Commission Chair Gary Gensler. The letter raised concerns that the SEC under Chair Gensler has failed to promote capital formation, weakened public markets, and decreased opportunities for investors. Lawmakers claimed under Chair Gensler's leadership, the commission has proposed more than 50 rules, none of which directly promote capital formation. They wrote that in 2022, IPO activity was the lowest in over three decades, with the number of IPOs falling by 78% and the capital raised in IPOs by 94% compared to the previous year. The lawmakers implored Chair Gensler to revise the SEC's rulemaking agenda by pursuing smart, incremental reforms that will strengthen U.S. public markets, expand opportunities for underrepresented entrepreneurs and investors, and encourage small businesses to grow, hire more workers, and go public. Number 9, on April 19th, the U.S. House of Representatives Financial Services Capital Markets Subcommittee held a hearing to examine legislative proposals intended to encourage capital formation and broaden the pool of investors in private markets, stressing that lawmakers must ensure that capital markets are working efficiently and effectively to provide companies access to the capital they need to innovate, grow, and create jobs. Subcommittee Chair Ann Wagner of Missouri stressed that policymakers should establish a regulatory framework that is streamlined and not overly burdensome, cautioning that failure to right-size regulation will stifle innovation, limit wealth-creating opportunities for investors, and prevent small businesses from reaching their potential. Arguing that business development companies are unduly penalized by the SEC because mutual funds that invest in business development companies are penalized by having to show a wrongful overstatement of their costs, Ranking Minority Member Brad Sherman of California highlighted his bill, the Access to Small Business Investor Capital Act. Representative Sherman's legislation would permit a registered investment company to exclude from the calculation of acquired fund fees and expenses those incurred indirectly from investment in a business development company. In addition, Representative Sherman argued that the current accredited investor definition is unfair and illogical and suggested that the definition should include two items. One, prohibit a private placement in which any individual accredited investor is putting more than 5 or perhaps 10% of their net worth in any one offering or more than 50% of their net worth in all private offerings. And two, ensure that an accredited investor has expertise or truly independent advisors that have the expertise to evaluate the investment. Number 8, on April 27th, the U.S. House of Representatives Financial Services Committee's Digital Assets, Financial Technology, and Inclusion Subcommittee held a hearing to examine the regulatory framework governing digital assets, observing that the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Commodity Futures Trading Commission disagree on the classification of many digital assets, and that the current disclosure regime does not produce information that a reasonable consumer would need to know before purchasing a digital asset. Subcommittee Chairman French Hill of Arkansas argued that there are glaring gaps in consumer and investor protections related to digital assets, and that regulation by enforcement does nothing to fill them. He stressed, moreover, that the SEC and the CFTC need direction from Congress, and caution that absent legislation, U.S. regulators are only pushing entrepreneurs, developers, and job creators offshore. He also announced that next month, the House Agriculture and Financial Services Committees will hold a joint hearing to evaluate the current regulatory framework governing digital assets. Observing that the U.S. has a comprehensive and longstanding framework of securities laws and rules designed to protect investors, promote market integrity, and facilitate capital formation, subcommittee ranking member Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts said his views align with SEC Chair Gary Gensler's assertion that most crypto assets are indeed securities and should be regulated as such, and argued that it seems unnecessary to reinvent the rules when the U.S. already has a regulatory regime that is indeed effective. Number seven, on April 7th, an industry working group issued a report on progress made and remaining challenges with respect to vote confirmation. The report of the end-to-end vote confirmation working group operations subcommittee to the staff of the U.S. Securities Exchange Commission identifies groundbreaking, if modest, progress toward what has been the holy grail for investors, proxy service providers, and other key participants in the proxy voting system, namely a means to ensure that investors' proxy votes are counted fully and accurately. The report summarizes the results of two 2022 initiatives of the Proxy Industry Working Group. One, a protocol that investors could use to seek end-to-end vote confirmation for the proxy season for Fortune 500 companies. And two, a pilot program to test whether manually reconciling entitlements to vote before votes are cast make voting confirmation more efficient, timely, and accurate. These initiatives were the first by a wide-ranging group of representatives of proxy industry firms, many of which are competitors. The End-to-End Confirmation Working Group was formed at the urging of Securities Exchange Commission staff after the SEC's November 2018 roundtable on the proxy system. The working group's operations subcommittee met 18 times to hammer out details of an agreed protocol for vote confirmation and a process for early reconciliation of vote entitlements. Dallas Stuckey, then president and CEO of the Society for Corporate Governance, co-chaired the working group initially with former CII Executive Director Ken Burch. After he retired in 2022, Amy Boris co-chaired the group. A group of vote tabulators and proxy service providers collaborated on a protocol for end-to-end vote confirmation, made it available to investors for 2,484 shareholder meetings in January through June of 2022. As the report notes, the protocol fell short of investors' expectations because it was clunky and time-consuming to use. For example, investors with holdings in the Russell 3000 needed to perform annual checks per custodian for each meeting. Investors also were disappointed that vote confirmation was not possible for meetings with proxy contests, for which vote confirmation may be critical. Although participants supported extending vote confirmation proxy contests, doing so would be costly, and there was no agreement on how the process should be funded. The early stage reconciliation pilot attempted to test a process for addressing over-reporting situations that occur when proxy votes received by the tabulator exceed the total number identified for the meeting by the bank or broker holding shares for beneficial owners. The pilot, which targeted votes at 20 meetings, shed light on the typical ways over-reporting occurs and streamlined the process for curing the over-reporting in some cases. Representatives of banks, brokers, tabulators, and proxy service providers who participated reported achieving a 99.85% acceptance level. Only a very few votes at the 20 meetings were rejected because of mismatches in shares reported and shares entitled to vote. But the process was manual and time-consuming, and participants did not think it was sustainable for all shareholder meetings. Number six, on April 14th, the United States Supreme Court issued a unanimous opinion in Axon versus Federal Trade Commission and the consolidated case of Securities Exchange Commission versus Cochran. The court held that the statutory review schemes established in the Securities Exchange Act and the Federal Trade Commission Act do not displace a district court's federal question jurisdiction over claims by a respondent in an administrative enforcement action challenging the constitutionality of the structure or existence of the SEC or FTC. Although it acknowledged that a special statutory review scheme may preclude district courts from exercising jurisdiction over challenges to federal agency action, the court stressed that such a scheme where the agency effectively fills in for the district court does not necessarily extend to every claim concerning agency action, citing its decision in Thunder Basin versus Risch. To consider whether particular claims were of the type Congress intended to be reviewed within a statutory review scheme, the court in Thunder Basin considered three factors. One, whether precluding district court jurisdiction could foreclose all meaningful judicial review of the claim. Two, whether the claim is wholly collateral to the statute's review provisions. And three, whether the claim is outside the agency's expertise. Applying these factors in the present case, the court held that all three factors point in the same direction toward allowing district court review of Axon's and Cochran's claims that the structure or even existence of an agency violates the Constitution. Accordingly, the court reversed the judgment of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and affirmed the decision of the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and remanded the cases for further proceedings, but expressed no view on the underlying constitutional claims regarding administrative adjudications. Number five, in an April 25th letter to S&P Dow Jones Indices, the Council of Institutional Investors expressed surprise and disappointment with S&P's recent decision to reopen the S&P 1500 composite and component indices to companies with multiple share class structures. CI's letter also questioned the opaque process that the index provider used to reach its decision. S&P announced the decision on April 17th. CII requested a meeting to discuss how and why S&P moved to reverse its 2017 decision to stop adding multiple class companies to these indices. April 27th, S&P agreed to meet with CII to discuss the issue. S&P closed the door to new multi-class companies in 2017 after CII, many of its members and other investor groups urged the major index providers to bar entry to benchmark indices to new multi-class companies. While the catalyst for the investor action was Snap Inc.'s idiosyncratic IPO, in which only non-voting shares were offered to the public, the initiative sprouted from broader investor fatigue with the proliferation of the imperial CEO governance model. Investors argue that including no vote in new multi-class structures would force passive investors, such as index funds, to invest in companies that give them little or no say in the governance of these companies, notwithstanding their capital at risk. S&P's decision surprised CII because in a November 2021 advisory panel hosted by S&P, CII's general counsel, yours truly, expressed strong support for keeping companies with multi-class share structures out of the indices. Other investor representatives who participated in the advisory panel discussion voiced similar views, and none of the participants expressed support for a change. Number four, on April 25th, the Council of Institutional Investors submitted a letter to the chairman and ranking member of the Committee on Financial Services of the U.S. House of Representatives. CII's letter generally supported H.R. 2795, the Enhancing Multi-Class Share Disclosures Act. The bill would amend the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 to require companies with multi-class stock structures to make certain disclosures in their proxy or consent solicitation materials. Legislation was introduced by Representative Gregory Meeks of New York and is one of many bills that were marked up on April 26 by the House Financial Services Committee. The substance of the bill, which CII first publicly supported back in 2018, derives from a recommendation issued by the Securities Exchange Commission's Investor Advisory Committee under the leadership of Harvard Law Professor John Coates. The required disclosures would report the voting power of each person who is a director, director nominee, or executive officer of the company, or who directly or indirectly holds 5% or more of the total combined voting power of all classes of securities entitled to vote in the election of directors. CII said in the letter that we believe that improving disclosure about public companies with multi-class structures is an important precursor to future legislation that would amend existing stock exchange listing standards to require meaningful time-based sunset. The committee approved the bill by a vote of 48-1. Fidium Financial Services also marked up 14 other pieces of legislation on April 26. Those bills focused on a number of issues, including expanding the definition of accredited investor, scaling back disclosure regulations for smaller companies, making electronic delivery the default, companies required regulatory documents, establishing an SEC Senior Investor Task Force, and requiring the SEC's Advocate for Small Business Capital Formation to provide educational resources and host events to promote capital raising options for traditionally underrepresented small businesses. Number three, in an April 27th letter, the Council of Institutional Investors asked the Financial Accounting Standards Board to add to its agenda two projects. One, elimination of the held maturity classification for debt securities, and two, improvement to financial instrument footnote disclosures regarding liquidity risk and interest rate risk. Letter explained that before its collapse, Silicon Valley Bank classified many of its assets as held maturity, did not explicitly disclose its liquidity risk, provided limited information about its interest rate risk. CII said in the letter that while financial accounting reporting was clearly not the cause Silicon Valley Bank's collapse, bank's failure raises legitimate questions about the appropriateness of certain provisions of the Financial Accounting Standards Board standards, including at least two items. One, the propriety of the classification of held maturity debt securities under Financial Accounting Standards Board accounting standards codification topic 320. And two, lack of required footnote disclosures about the liquidity risk and interest rate risk of financial instruments under the Financial Accounting Standards Board accounting standards codification topic 825. CII's letter included arguments for eliminating the held maturity classification made by the CFA Institute's head of financial reporting, Sandy Peters, Berkshire Hathaway CEO Warren Buffett, Fifth Bank Corp CEO Timothy Spence, New York University accounting professor Stephen Ryan, and the U.S. General Accounting Office in a 1991 report on bank failures. Correspondents also highlighted a statement made in 2016 by two former FASB members, Tom Linsmeyer and Mark Siegel. Their statement expressed disappointment with the FASB's decision not to require additional disclosures to provide investors with a better understanding of the interest rate risk and liquidity risk of financial instruments. CII's letter provided recommendations for footnote disclosures of information about both types of risk. Number two, on April 28th, the Federal Reserve Board published a report presenting, one, the results of Vice Chair for Supervision Michael S. Barr's review of the supervision of regulation of Silicon Valley Bank and its holding company, Silicon Valley Bank Financial Group, and the factors that contributed to the bank's failure, and two, potential changes to strengthen the Federal Reserve Board's supervision and regulation of large banking organizations. The report finds that Silicon Valley Bank Financial Group's board of directors and management failed to effectively oversee the risks inherent in the bank's business model and balance sheet strategies, including a high level of reliance on uninsured deposits that left the firm acutely exposed to the specific combination of rising interest rates and slowing activity in the technology sector that materialized in 2022 and early 2023. Specifically, the report observes that in the days prior to its failure, Silicon Valley Bank experienced a bank run fueled by social media, which led the firm's concentrated network of depositors to withdraw uninsured deposits in a coordinated manner at an unprecedented rate. Although supervisors issued a number of supervisory findings in the 4 years leading up to Silicon Valley Bank's failure, the Federal Reserve Board did not appreciate the seriousness of critical deficiencies in the firm's governance, liquidity, and interest rate risk management, and did not take sufficient steps to ensure that Silicon Valley Bank addressed those risks in a timely fashion. Further, the report argues that Silicon Valley Bank rapidly grew between 2019 and 2021 under the direction of the vice chair for supervision. Supervisory practices shifted and staff approached supervisory messages with a need to accumulate more evidence than in the past, which contributed to delays and in some cases led staff not to take action. The report also asserts that the Federal Reserve's tailoring framework in response to S-2155, the Economic Growth Regulatory Relief and Consumer Protection Act, and related shift in the stance of supervisory policy impeded effective supervision by reducing standards, increasing complexity, and promoting a less assertive supervisory approach. Noting that absent these changes, Silicon Valley Bank would have been subject to, among other standards, enhanced liquidity risk management requirements, full standardized liquidity requirements, and supervisory stress testing at an earlier date. The report finds that these requirements may have resulted in Silicon Valley Bank's having increased capital and liquidity that would have bolstered its resilience and may have also encouraged greater scrutiny of Silicon Valley Bank's position, leading the firm to more proactively manage its liquidity and capital positions or maintain a different balance sheet composition. In a letter accompanying the report, Vice Chair for Supervision Barr outlined several recommendations to improve the speed, force, and agility of supervision and strengthen the Federal Reserve Board's regulatory framework for large banks, noting a need to bolster resiliency broadly in the financial system and not focus solely on specific risk drivers. In regard to supervision, he suggests that the Federal Reserve Board, among other measures, consider requiring firms with inadequate capital planning, liquidity risk management, or governance and controls to hold additional capital and liquidity in appropriate cases, or be subject to limits on capital distributions or incentive compensation. With respect to regulation, he reiterates that the Federal Reserve Board's plans to revisit the tailoring framework, including to reevaluate a range of rules for banks with $100 billion or more in assets. Specifically, he suggests that the Federal Reserve Board take two actions. One, reevaluate the stability of uninsured deposits and the treatment of held-to-maturity securities in its standardized liquidity rules and in internal liquidity stress tests. And two, consider applying standardized liquidity requirements to a broader set of firms. Vice Chair for Supervision Barr also notes that the Federal Reserve Board will evaluate how to improve its capital requirements by requiring a broader universe of firms to take into account unrealized gains or losses on available for sale securities. He stresses, however, that any such modifications to the Federal Reserve Board's capital liquidity regulations would be subject to a notice and comment period, have appropriate transition periods, and therefore would not be effective for several years. And in my opinion, the number one most significant development in U.S. corporate governance, capital market regulation, period from April 4th to May 2nd, occurred on April 18th, when the U.S. House of Representatives Financial Services Committee held an oversight hearing in which Securities Exchange Commission Chair Gary Gensler was the sole witness. At that hearing, Chair Gensler was grilled for more than 4 hours about issues ranging from the length of the commission's rulemaking comment periods to whether the SEC has the authority to implement a climate disclosure rule. One committee member, Representative Warren Davidson of Ohio, was so incensed by Chair Gensler's, quote, long series of abuses, unquote, that he announced he was introducing legislation to remove him as SEC chair and replace the role of an executive director who would report to a board. Under Representative Davidson's bill, former SEC chairs could not serve as executive directors. Chair Gensler did not seem rattled by the hammering and hewed closely to comments he's made before about pending rulemaking. While most of the questions directed at Chair Gensler dealt with how the SEC is overseeing cryptocurrency, many of the questions also related to the number and pace of commission rulemakings generally. Committee Chair Patrick McHenry of North Carolina said, quote, time and time again, you have cut the public out of the rulemaking process with unreasonably short comment periods, even for major rules like your disastrous climate disclosure proposal and equity market structure overhaul, unquote. Representative Ann Wagner of Missouri referred to the SEC's, quote, overly aggressive agenda, and accused Chair Gensler of, quote, racing through rulemakings at a frenzied pace, unquote. Chair Gensler said that under his leadership, the SEC has undertaken 46 rulemakings, not 53, as Chair McHenry had stated in his remarks. Chair Gensler said the confusion over the total number may be due to some reopenings of comment periods for existing proposals. Chair Gensler also explained that the average comment period was 70 days, and the SEC continues to take comments and engage with trade associations and market participants after comment periods have ended. Chair Gensler also noted that the commission set a 105-day comment period for its most recent rulemakings on market structure reforms and has received approximately 20,000 comments. Ranking Member Maxine Waters of California came to Chair Gensler's defense, noting that the SEC has provided twice the legally required time for comments. She added that these reforms are not rushed. They are overdue. Many Republican members of the committee attacked the SEC's proposed climate disclosure rules. Representative Alex Mooney of West Virginia said, quote, the SEC may be the agency that most directly threatens the livelihoods of West Virginians today, unquote. He added that the SEC's proposed climate change disclosure rule is, quote, about naming and shaming fossil fuel companies, unquote, and he estimated that it could cost companies more than $100 million to comply. Representative Bill Heising of Michigan chastised Chair Gensler for not responding in a meaningful way to his request for more information about the proposed climate disclosure rules, including legal memoranda that the SEC is relying on to justify the proposal's constitutionality and details about which agencies or non-governmental organizations the SEC coordinated with when drafting the proposal. He said Chair Gensler replied to him by sending publicly available documents. Representative Heising also said the SEC failed to analyze the climate disclosure rules to determine if they will increase energy costs. Other Republican members of the committee expressed strong concerns about how smaller companies and family farms may be burdened by having to report their Scope 3 emissions. Some Democrats on the committee pushed back. Representative Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts said, quote, climate change is real and savings are at risk. Cheerleaders for big oil want to weaken this rule, unquote. Representative Rashida Tlaib of Michigan noted that a European Union disclosure directive expected to go into effect this summer would require disclosure of Scope 3 emissions and would apply to an estimated 70% of U.S. public companies. She said that if Europe is requiring Scope 3 disclosure, the SEC's rule should also require it. Chair Gensler repeatedly told lawmakers and investors had asked for more information about the risks presented by climate change to help them make investment decisions, and some companies already are providing it. He explained, quote, we're trying to bring consistency to that information, unquote. The SEC chair also emphasized that the SEC has authority only over public companies, so it cannot require small businesses or family farms to disclose Scope 3 emissions. The SEC chair emphasized that the commission is merit neutral and as such is not trying to promote an environmental agenda. He said more disclosure would help uncover instances of greenwashing. Chair Gensler conceded that the SEC is considering concerns raised about Scope 3 and is open to making adjustments to the rules. Representative Medea Velasquez of New York asked if, in the wake of recent bank collapse, the SEC was taking action to prevent CEOs at failing banks from receiving big payouts in the future. Chair Gensler pointed to the SEC's recent implementation of the Dodd-Frank clawback and pay for performance disclosure rules and the SEC's Rule 10b5-1 reforms. Chair Gensler said all of those are preventing the same situation from occurring at non-bank public companies, and the SEC has to work with bank regulators to enact similar regulations at financial institutions. That completes my monthly U.S. Corporate Governance Capital Markets Update. If you have any questions regarding any of the issues discussed, please feel free to email me at Jeff, that's J-E-F-F, at CII.org. Until next time, I'm Jeff Mahoney. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Voice of Corporate Governance, brought to you by the Council of Institutional Investors. The Voice of Corporate Governance is a free, non-sponsored podcast that highlights critical developments in corporate governance and other important issues affecting institutional investors. The views expressed by those interviewed on the podcast do not necessarily reflect the views of CII or its members. For more information on CII and its policies on corporate governance, please visit our website at www.cii.org.